all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Good afternoon. I am Jim Fossone, your Veterans Radio host today on WAM 1600 Talk Radio. We've got great programs. In the first half, we're going to talk to the founder of Purple Hearts Reunited, an interesting nationwide program. And in the second half, we'll talk to Noah Currier, a disabled veteran who started a foundation called Oscar Mike on the Move to help disabled veterans keep moving after their disabilities. You'll like both of these programs, so stick around after a short break for our sponsors.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veteran Radio today Major Zachary Fike of the Vermont Army National Guard. Major, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, it's an honor to be here with you today. Thank you.
Well, it's a great project that I'll call it that you have ongoing. We're going to talk about Purple Hearts Reunited. But before we begin that, let's talk a little bit about who you are, Zach. Tell us your background a little bit, how you got yourself into the military, and what your current assignment is.
Yeah, absolutely. I come from a military family. Both my dad and mom served in the United States Army. My dad was a career veteran, 26 years, and my mom did about six, and was one of the very first drill corporals going through the drill sergeant school back in the late 70s. So I got away with nothing growing up, and they made me the man I am today growing up in a house with two drill sergeants. But, you know, I enlisted. I followed in their footsteps, started as an E1 nothing, and I've now moved over to the dark side, if you will, in 2004, and I'm now a commissioned officer in the rank of major. I currently serve as an infantry officer in the Vermont Army National Guard full-time, so active duty, and this June is 20 years of service for me.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that service and the long family of service. We hear that often on Veterans Radio. We're talking to Major Zach Fike. Major, you've had some deployments as well. Tell us a little bit about your deployments and maybe your up close and personal with the Purple Heart.
Yeah, absolutely. I have combat deployments to both Iraq and Afghanistan. Both obviously were filled with good and bad. Don't regret any of my deployments. We did some tremendous things. Unfortunately, we lost some soldiers on both deployments. Never want to see a friend leave the earth, but obviously they sacrificed for the greater good. Myself, I was wounded September 11th of 2010. The enemy likes to launch attacks on days that mean something to us. Obviously, 9/11 is a big deal for us in our history. I was very fortunate to survive that attack. And I'm here to tell you about it. So it's an honor to be a wounded veteran in our country, but it's absolutely not why I started the foundation Purple Hearts Reunited, and we can talk about that here in a little bit.
No, I think this is a great transition. The history here, if you will, is back in about 2009, I think. Your mother ran across a Purple Heart in an antique shop and gave it to you as a gift, and that sort of changed your direction, maybe, what you spend your spare time on. Tell us a little bit about that initial contact with that antique Purple Heart and what it caused you to do.
Yeah, after my deployment to Iraq in 2005, 2006, I had a good friend of mine. He was an Army Green Beret. And he collected antiques, specifically military antiques. And I loved going to his home because it was like going to a museum. And he started to take me along on these treasure hunts, if you will. And it was really exciting, and I found it very therapeutic. And, you know, when soldiers go off to war, they come back different people, whether they're willing to admit it or not. And we all need to find something of interest to keep our minds occupied and to deal with some of the stressors that, you know, obviously you experience in combat. And I just kind of taken a liking to collecting. And as I started to venture into those shops, I started to see discarded military items. And it really broke my heart to think that that helmet or that uniform or that medal could have belonged to my grandfather or my father or my mother. And I started to rescue those items and became a military collector. That's the reason why my mom bought that Purple Heart for Christmas. But as soon as I saw it, I knew that medal didn't belong to me. And it set me on a journey to find that soldier's family.
And tell us a little bit about that first Purple Heart and the family that was associated with it.
He was a World War II veteran from a little town called Watertown, New York, right outside of Fort Drum. He was a very handsome man, well-liked in the community, Italian family. His family came over when he was 3 years old. He was proud to be an American. That's why he decided to volunteer to serve. And unfortunately, like many others, he did not come home. Unfortunately, his family was very heartbroken over that incident. His mom died shortly after of a heart attack. She was just completely heartbroken. And over time, the family kind of separated. And through that process, that medal was unfortunately lost. But when we contacted them, they were completely ecstatic. This was a medal that wasn't supposed to be out of the family hands. And around the return process or the return ceremony, this family decided to have their first ever family reunion. And it was a beautiful moment to see 80 family members traveling in from all over the country, literally meeting for the first time all around the memory of this lost brother or lost cousin. And it was a magical moment, and it got a lot of national attention. And literally the next day, we started receiving Purple Hearts from all over the country.
And this first medal was just simply you trying to connect it back to the family from which it came. You didn't have any grand plans. This was just, hey, I'm going to do this one thing. And it really snowballed from there, didn't it?
Yeah, everything we do about this foundation is literally just by circumstance. It was kind of one of those meant to be things. I didn't sit down over coffee or over beer and say, I'm going to start a nonprofit. To be quite honest with you, when the family visited me at my home, my plan was to hand them this medal and say thank you. And it was actually their ideal to hold the ceremony. They wanted to have that family reunion. And once we saw the impact of bringing a family together again, it became more than just a medal. And we've seen that countless times across the country. At times, that medal becomes the least important thing of the process. Reuniting a family, families having family reunions, siblings talking to each other for the first time in over 20 years because of a family dispute. Grandson seeing a picture of their grandfather for the first time, literally never had a photo of him, and getting to see what he looked like for the first time. Introducing a hero to a town that didn't realize that that hero was from their town, and seeing a city worker on bended knee chiseling his name into a memorial, you know, those are some of our proudest moments. So those second, third, and fourth order effects really are the most important thing, and that's why we believe in keeping this going and having those ceremonies.
Well, Purple Hearts Reunited is a 501c3 charity, and its goal or mission is to take these discarded, lost, misplaced Purple Hearts and get them back to the families when possible. And there are actually a couple of types of Purple Hearts. Some have the names engraved on them and some of them don't. Can you explain to us a little bit about the difference and the detective work that has to go into it?
Yeah, typically there's three ways that a Purple Heart will be engraved. First is posthumously. So the soldier was killed in battle. The government traditionally, starting in World War II, would have that medal engraved, and then that medal is presented to their families. That's still a tradition today, and I've unfortunately had the duty of doing that for several families. You have replacement engraving. If there's any veterans out there listening, if you've lost your medals, you can contact the National Public Records Center, archives.gov, and you can put in a medal request, and they will send your medals to you free of charge. And depending on the level of award, i.e. a Purple Heart, it will come engraved. And then the third way, or the third set of medals that we typically see, are what we call personal engravings. My medal was not engraved because I was not killed in combat. I simply took my medals to Things Remembered and had it engraved, and I gave it to my mom. So through all those different types and styles of engravings and time periods, we're able to essentially look at that medal, which offers up those specific clues, which helps me and our research team narrow down on exactly who we're looking for, from what time period, and then we go into the extensive piece of figuring out who your grandparents were and working our way down until we find a living descendant.
Now, there are about 1.8 Purple Hearts that have been awarded in the country. This goes back all the way to George Washington's time, as we know. How do you do the detective work to track down the, not only you might have a name, but a lot of names are pretty darn common in this country. How do you sort out the right guys?
That's why it's important that we see the medal. If I had the ability over the radio to show you what a medal from World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam looked like, there's subtle differences in how the medal was manufactured over time, how the ribbon was sewn. There's subtle clues that will allow me to at least steer into the time period to know if it is a common name like John Smith, I can at least look for the John Smiths from World War I versus looking at Vietnam, if that makes sense. So each medal in its own way speaks to us, and we're able to clue in and do our best to identify the correct veteran, and then obviously identify the family and get that back to them.
And we're talking to Major Zach Fike of the Vermont Army National Guard. He's active duty with them, but in his spare time, which we all know is fairly limited, he's founder and involved with Purple Hearts Reunited. Zach, how many medals have you received, and where do you get them from? And how many have you been able to reunite with people?
So you spoke about that magic number, that 1.8 million. Obviously, that's an estimated number. We as a country did not track the number of recipients by time period, which is a big shame, in my opinion. It's a very important medal. It's our nation's oldest medal. And to me, it signifies the ultimate sacrifice. And of that 1.8 million to date, we've returned close to 500. And so we're just scratching the surface. We're receiving record number of medals every day. We're up to almost 2 medals a day on average that are coming to us. And they're being found in the most amazing ways. Old abandoned homes, vehicles, furniture, metal detector enthusiasts are finding them buried in the ground. Airline tarmac, so it fell out of somebody's luggage. New York City taxi cabs. One of my favorite stories, a couple years ago, a dog, while digging in the backyard, found the medal while digging and became not only the first dog in our history that I know of to find a Purple Heart, but became the first dog that I know of to return that medal. It was a pretty special ceremony. But if you can envision a way a medal can be lost, we've heard about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the reuniting ceremonies. Now, I assume you're getting these from all over the country.
Absolutely. It's completely up to the family on how they want to process the ceremony. Some families are very private, and we respect that. We don't want to push families into a situation where they're uncomfortable. And there's times where we'll just simply mail the medal to them. But there are families out there that want the ability to memorialize their loved one that they lost, just like Corrado in that first medal return. And we respect that, and we think that's important. So we'll go ahead. We'll have the medals professionally framed, free of charge. And myself, one of my employees, or one of our many volunteers across the country will hand deliver that frame to that family in a special ceremony. And they're just beautiful moments, you know, to see that family come together, to hear some of the information about their loved one for the first time. It's a big deal, and it means the world to them, and we as a country owe it to them to hold that ceremony and to memorialize that loved one that never came home.
Well, we've certainly helped some folks get their Purple Hearts, living veterans who never really got them. And I can tell you that when they are presented with their Purple Heart, it's often the first time the rest of the family has really heard, geez, this is what Dad did or my uncle did. It is quite moving for the family, isn't it, Zach?
Absolutely. A couple years ago, I was sitting at the table of a World War II veteran who was wounded. Someone broke into his home and stole his Purple Heart out of his sock drawer. And as I sat there listening to him for about 3 hours, literally tell us the story from start to finish of him joining the Army and then his experiences through the war. And when he finished speaking, I looked over to his daughter, who was sitting next to me the whole time, and she was completely in tears. And I felt bad. I said, "Ma'am, are you okay?" And she said, "That's the first time I've ever heard him speak of his service." And, you know, this woman was in her 60s. So it was a powerful moment, and it made me proud to think that that daughter got to experience that one moment. And it was a fortunate thing because he died 2 years later. So, you know, without going the distance and helping that man, maybe that daughter would have never known, and that would have been very unfortunate.
It really, that story really shows us, Zach, that it's not just the country's history that these medals are part of, but it's really that family history that's interwoven with it. And while the most veterans, you know, we're not in it for the medals. As you say, you were lucky. Nothing worse happened. You got a Purple Heart, but it's not something to brag about. But it creates an opportunity for the family to have that sort of discussion. And it's unfortunate that so many of these occur a generation later, after the veteran who received the Purple Heart has gone. Of those 500 or so that you've been involved in reuniting, are most of them with deceased veterans and you're doing it with the family versus the veteran?
It's about 95%. We have done living returns. They're obviously rare. Most veterans still alive have their medals. But we have done some living returns, oldest being World War II. We've turned medals to current veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's always great to honor one of my fellow brothers and sisters from current time. And, you know, I can't stress enough how important these are. And at the end of the day, I'll say it again, the medal becomes the least important piece of it. You know, to sit with a sister of a veteran who lost her brother in World War II, she lived her whole life in fear of his death. And, you know, that big brother to her was everything. You know, he walked her to the school bus every day and took care of her and watched after her. And when he didn't come home, she was lost for the rest of her life. And to present that medal on her deathbed and to see her staring literally through my soul, she wasn't looking at Zach Fike. She was looking at her brother. And if that brought her some peace in the last moments of her life, it was worth every single second we put into that. And even if that medal gets lost again, it was completely worth the effort to bring a little bit of peace to a sister before she dies.
Well, it's really important work. And one of the things that I assume you give along with the medal is the DOD citations. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
That's rare for us, actually. Typically, what we'll do is we'll return whatever is sent to us. Some cases, it's just a loose medal. Some cases, we get the entire record to include all the citations, accompanying documentation, letters from the president, handwritten letters from the veteran, two girlfriends, letters from their commanders back to family members. So it all depends, and we'll frame all of those appropriately. And then there are cases where we'll help a veteran, just like we did last week. A Vietnam veteran was wounded, never received his heart. We worked with his local congressional delegation. They were able to verify the award. Those came in, and we presented those to him at the Vietnam Wall in front of his family and friends, and it was a great ceremony.
You have a very robust website. Can you give folks the how they can get to it and find out some more information about Purple Hearts Reunited?
Yeah, you can visit us at purpleheartsreunited.org. That's purple like the color, hearts with an S, and then reunited all together. You can visit us on Facebook or Twitter, Purple Hearts Reunited. And quite frankly, if you need help, give us a ring. If you find a medal, send it to us. We'd be happy to put a good researcher on it and do our best to return it. And at the end of the day, we're trying to do the best we can, and we're not going to stop until we can get all these medals home to where they belong.
And you would encourage folks to volunteer to be of assistance in the reuniting ceremonies. If somebody's out in Wyoming and you've got one out there, is that something somebody can help you with?
Yeah, we actually have something called the Valor Guard, and the Valor Guard has allowed us to expand. Last year, we did 100 returns across the country. We're on track to do 150 this year. If you're a veteran out there and you're willing to assist, you know, reach out to us. Send us a short bio of who you are. And obviously, if it's a good fit, you know, we can assign you by area. And like you said, if I have a medal for Oregon or Kansas and you're in that area, we'd have no problem sending you the frame and asking you to go forward to do that return for us. At the end of the day, it's not about Zach Fike doing that return. It's just about getting that medal home. So the more help we can get, the better. And we can probably do a couple hundred of these a year, no problem.
And there is a way for people to financially support the organization as well. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's no charge to the family, obviously nothing is free these days. We do have a lot of assistance out there that allows us to cut costs. But there is travel cost to what we do. There's framing cost to what we do. And believe it or not, there's actual rescue cost to rescuing some of these medals. Some of these medals are traded and collected like baseball cards. There's a very large market for Purple Hearts, specifically posthumous Purple Hearts. Last year alone, we spent roughly $50,000 to rescue these medals from collecting sites, eBay, Craigslist, etc. So between those, there is an associated cost, and every dollar helps, and every dollar goes back into returning medals. So any love you can send us is greatly appreciated.
Well, I think we all certainly applaud the work that you and your team are doing. You've got a great list of sponsors who have provided monetary support and other in-kind support. You want to give a plug for a couple of those great sponsors?
Yeah, we got a personal, Amir Hott, great friend out of New York City, has helped us a lot in the past. The Military Order of the Purple Heart have been big supporters. Literally everyone, VFW, American Legion. We got a small band or small army behind us, great people, and we couldn't be any more appreciative, and we obviously couldn't do it without them. And I feel blessed every day to have this mission. Sometimes it's tiring, but it's worth it. And we're not going to stop. We're going to keep moving forward one foot at a time. And it's the least we could do for these families out there.
Well, we want to thank you, Zach Fike, for being with us today on Veterans Radio, to helping spread the news about Purple Hearts Reunited. And in your role as a major in the Vermont Army National Guard, I know you're in queue for another overseas deployment in probably 2019. We wish you Godspeed and good health.
Hey, I'm happy to do it. Serving my country has been the greatest honor I've ever had, other than being a husband and father. And I'm happy to do it for everyone out there. And I'll come home safe. And it's great to be an American these days.
Well, that's just one of the great stories that we bring you here on Veterans Radio. It's coming up on 15 years that Veterans Radio has been on the air, and we can only bring you these great stories when you give us story ideas. So we want you to reach out to us on Facebook or send us an email, give us additional story ideas for Dale and Bob and myself, Jim Fossone, to talk about here on Veterans Radio. We really appreciate the support we get out of WHAM 1600 Talk Radio. And after the news, we'll come back and have another great interview with Noah Currier, who started Oscar Mike, a foundation and an apparel company to support disabled veterans get involved in athletic events that they can participate in. Noah is going to be a speaker at a luncheon for the Michigan Paralyzed Veterans Association, Michigan PVA, in November. I think after you hear this speech, you're going to go to MichiganPVA.org and buy luncheon tickets for that great event supporting that great organization. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone, and before we get started with our interview about Oscar Mike, I want to tell you about the Warrior Appreciation Rally on Sunday, July 22nd, up in Frankenmuth. It's put on by the Frankenmuth VFW Post 2725 and the Village of Frankenmuth. This is their fifth annual program. It's a day of fun and support for military, police, EMS, and firemen, whether they be active, discharged, or retired. You can learn more about this by going to or calling Larry at 989-652-6823 and get out and support this program. Now, let's turn our attention to Noah Currier and Oscar Mike. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Noah Currier, a former Marine. And Noah, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Well, we're glad to have you on to talk about your experiences, as well as getting around to talking about Oscar Mike, both a foundation and an apparel company that you founded to support the foundation. But before we get to that, let's back up. How did a nice boy like you from Illinois end up in the Marines?
Well, you could blame it on one of two things. It was either watching Full Metal Jacket way too many times, or the fact that my father had served in the Marine Corps in the early 70s, right at the end of Vietnam.
And this was a direction that you were sure you were heading to when you were in high school. Tell us how you joined up.
Well, it was a lot earlier than that in life that I knew that. I used to like paint the Eagle Globe and Anchor in art classes, dating back to elementary school, I think. And, you know, it was just something I always wanted to do. Because for some reason I thought that crawling through mud and muck and the jungles looked really cool. Didn't end up getting to do any of that because we spent most of the time in either desert or mountains. But either way, it was what I wanted. And I joined when I was 17. I signed up for the delayed entry program, and that was supposed to be a 12-month thing, and then I think I was supposed to leave in October or November after I graduated high school, but I ended up getting in a little bit of trouble. I got in a fight, and I had to leave a few months earlier than expected, which put me in the unit that I was in because of the timing, and I think everything ended up happening for a reason, and I got to be surrounded by what I would consider some of the greatest guys on the planet when I was in my unit in 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion, Charlie Company. And I joined during peacetime. I did not know if there was going to ever be a war. As a matter of fact, when I was 17 and my mom was signing the paperwork for me for the delayed entry program, my recruiter at the time, I was the first guy that he was recruiting, and he was at my house, and I had him flip to infantry and recon in the big book that he brought of all the different jobs or MOSs. And my mom said, told him to hold on, and asked him if I joined one of those fields, if he could guarantee that I'd never have to go to war if there ever was one. And I remember his reply was, man, we haven't been to war in about 10 years. I don't think that's going to be a problem, but I also could never guarantee that.
Well, and the back part of that statement was right. He shouldn't have guaranteed anything. Let's put the timing on this. You joined up in 2000.
Yep. That's when I left.
And ended up in a unit that became deployed to Afghanistan following the attacks of September 11th.
Yeah, we didn't really do anything for Afghanistan. It was too early on, and we really just offloaded some equipment into Pakistan and did, I think, some convoy security there. But I wasn't really a part of any significant operation there. We just spent a lot of time sitting off the coast waiting for orders. And we never got them on that deployment. So what we called it Operation Enduring Boredom on the ship while all these Marines sat around waiting for the orders that never came through. And we were gone for almost a year on that deployment and came home for a couple months and, got sent right back over. And this time, was I think the end of the year in 2002 when we left and, we ended up in Kuwait, and on March 19th, 2003, we invaded Iraq, and my unit got to be the point unit for the Marine Corps for the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, then there's a whole other story that starts right there.
Yeah. Now, before we get there, you're in the Marine Corps for about 3 years or so at this point, 3 or 4 years. Did it meet the expectations? Because you said you'd sort of your whole life, this is where you were thinking you should go. Did it meet those expectations?
I wouldn't trade my experiences for the world. I was hoping to make it into another MOS to graduate from where I was to another one, but those two deployments kind of kept me affixed to that unit. And like I said, I was surrounded by some of the greatest human beings on the planet, so I don't regret anything. I just, you know, I always had hopes to make it to some other MOSs.
And the after the tour into Iraq, you come back in 2004, I believe, back to Camp Pendleton?
Yeah, it was actually still 2003 at the time. And when we got back, and 3 days, well, the fourth day after we got back, I was in a vehicle with another Marine turning onto Camp Pendleton, and he fell asleep at the wheel, and there's a big hill right there that we rolled down, and I broke my neck in the accident, and, you know, woke up in a hospital a few days later, paralyzed from the neck down.
So having survived Iraq, you come back and get in an automobile accident outside Camp Pendleton where you get a C6 spinal cord injury. Explain to our listeners who may not understand the severity of that kind of spinal cord break what that all means.
Well, when you break a vertebrae in your neck, depending on where it's at, it really dictates the amount of function that you have. They use the term paralyzed from the neck down, although I can still use muscles in my arms. I still have shoulders. I have one of my triceps. I have forearms, and I have my biceps. So my hands don't work, and one of my triceps doesn't work, but the rest of my arm muscles do. So I can still propel a wheelchair, and I'm not breathing on a ventilator or anything like that. But if you break up a little bit higher, you obviously lose more arm muscles, and depending on how high it is, like C2, 3, and sometimes 4, you end up on a ventilator.
Now, Noah, at the time this happens, I mean, you're probably in the best shape of your life, aren't you?
Yeah, that is definitely a fact.
And that conditioning certainly has some impact in your outcomes, but you were in a coma, I've read, for like 5 days.
Yeah, and I believe that was a medically induced coma. I think they need you to either not move your head or try to keep the swelling down during that time. So they give you a steroid in your neck, and I believe they try to keep you on ice for a little while to keep, because the real damage in the spinal cord comes from swelling around it, and it never, that kind of swelling turns into like almost like a scar tissue. It's gray matter around the spinal cord, almost like the human brain. And it never really recovers after an impact like that unless you can keep the swelling down to a minimum.
How old were you at the time of the auto accident, Noah?
I was 21 years old.
So when you come to out of the coma and you begin assessing your situation, tell us what's going through a 21-year-old's mind.
I guess I don't know if it was in the coma or how I knew that there was anybody else in the room at the time, but when I opened my eyes, I had some family members in the room, and they brought in a couple of the nurses and a doctor, and they give you this big board in front of you that has 100 symbols on it, and they want to see if your brain is still working all right, and they want you to basically, you know, point out a sentence or make some sense out of something, because your hands don't work either. I was on I was intubated, so I couldn't speak, and I pointed at the question mark, then I pointed at the flame, and then I pointed at the nurse symbol, and my dad looked around the room and he said, he's going to be just fine.
Your sense of humor remained intact.
That is true, and I was pretty positive, because I thought that, it didn't matter really what a doctor said. They couldn't assess my situation that accurately. I had a friend that maybe a year prior broke his back and spent some months in a wheelchair, but was able to walk out of the hospital eventually. And I thought, even though they told me that I would never walk again, in my mind I said, well, they don't know me very well. And, I still was really positive and worked really hard, and come to find out those doctors knew more than I did.
Well, that positive attitude is really what's so important in life, as no matter what challenges you face. But unfortunately, things didn't get better or even immediately better. Your girlfriend of many years had a tragedy of her own that impacted your recovery. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was really positive in the hospital and kept that attitude and came home and back to my girlfriend of, at the time, about 7.5 years. And she called me up one night and, after only being home a short time, said that she had to work late that night. And I said, that's all right, I'm already in bed. And I said, I'll see you whenever you get here. And I woke up in the morning and she wasn't there. And the phone started ringing right when I woke up. And when the phone started ringing, it's like something inside me told me, and I already knew what had happened. But I heard my mom pick up the phone down the hall because I was living with her at the time. And she said hello, and then there was silence for a little while. And then I heard the phone fall and hit the floor, and I heard her drop to her knees and start crying. And I knew before she even told me that she had passed away. And she fell asleep at the wheel driving home to my house that night.
And you have to, at that point in your own mind, wonder, how much more can I carry? How much more weight and bad news do I have to go through?
Yeah, I gave up on any sort of positive thinking at that moment in time. And it lasted for a number of years. I was not myself for a very long time, and did things to try to hurt myself often. And thankfully, I made it through that period of time. But, there was something that helped pull me out of that. And like I said, it took a few years for that to happen, though.
Well, and I've read that, you not only, used the drugs VA prescribed for you, but you found your way into street drugs. As you say, you contemplated hurting yourself or becoming one of the suicide statistics. But what did you tell yourself to kind of get through, one day at a time?
I wasn't very good at that, actually. The thing that kept me from pulling the trigger every night was the fact that I lived with my mom, and my mom had had such a rough time while I was overseas in Iraq and then going through my accident, and I didn't want to just stack up another thing on her plate and have her walk in my room with my brains all over the back of the pillow, you know? So she, in a sense, kept me alive without even saying a word. I couldn't put that on her. And I tried to talk myself into it every day, but at the end of every day, as much as I wanted to hurt myself, I didn't want to hurt her. So, thankfully she was still in my life, and, without even knowing, it kept me alive.
Many of the stories we've told on Veterans Radio really involve that family or friend who keeps you going through the darkest of days so that you can wake up just one more time. Ultimately, it was from friends kicking you in the behind about getting involved in some adaptive sports. Tell us how long it took you to say, well, I'll give it a try, and what the impact of it was.
It was about 6 years. And for the last two of those 6 years, I had been telling this friend no. He was trying to talk me into going skiing in Colorado. And my response is always, dude, I'm a quadriplegic. You know, that doesn't even make sense. You can't take me skiing somewhere. And he would say, yes, I can. And you got to see how these things work. He was another guy in a chair, but he was a paraplegic. And I thought, he had a much better he fared a better chance of making it down a hill than I did, because he could hold onto those handheld outriggers and keep his balance and things like that. But I eventually listened to him, and I went with to Aspen. And one day when we got there, I took that lift all the way to the top of the mountain, my very first run. And it was a life-changing experience. And I always try to figure out what it was exactly that made that switch flip in that moment. And I think what it boiled down to is I was scared. And I was scared about something, a decision that I had said, made for myself, that I was going up to the top, because they let me, we got off the lift at the halfway point, and then we got on another one to go all the way up to the top. And that was something that I had asked for. And we got up to the top, I was afraid, and in a good way, because, when you're an adrenaline junkie prior to your accident, and you get off on, either going fast at something or hard or something that could potentially really hurt you or even kill you, it really makes you feel alive in that moment. And that's how I felt right there. And, raced down that mountain, and it was a life-changing experience. When I got down to the bottom, I met a bunch of other guys that had crazy stories like mine. So I had some peers there to talk me through some of the hard things I was going through. I signed up for a skydiving event right after that. I signed up for the National Veteran Wheelchair Games, and I enrolled myself in school. All within, a matter of 2 months after getting back, all of that stuff had happened. So that, it's just a testament to that one moment in time changed my whole trajectory. And, and eventually I wanted to be able to offer that same experience to other people.
Well, I think it's some of the pearls of wisdom you're giving us here is the power of family, right? Mom helped you get through the end of it without saying a word in some regards, because you didn't want to make her life any worse. You had a friend who for 2 years didn't give up trying to motivate you to go out to adaptive skiing, and that pearl of wisdom is those of us out there talking to people shouldn't give up. Don't let them say no once. Here, this guy had to stay on you for 2 years. And the third pearl of wisdom here is, there's something to be said for getting back in the game and the adrenaline that comes from it to make you feel that you're living life again, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, you can't always stay in your comfort zone, especially not if you ever want to improve a situation or excel at life in anything. You really got to throw yourself in the lion's den once in a while because, you know, it's much like getting in a fight in school when you're a kid. It teaches you a lot about yourself, not your capability of fighting or survival, but how you handle those moments of pressure.
And one of the things you found out at the adaptive sports games and the National Veterans Wheelchair Games was that a lot of the guys could or couldn't come back the next time around if they didn't have the right financing, and that moved you into the foundation and the company called Oscar Mike. Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, shortly after that event, I went to the National Veteran Wheelchair Games. And, you know, I think I had gotten sponsored to my first two events. And, you know, you realize then that, and they tell you it ahead of time, that usually your first year, it's a little bit easier to find whether it's, you know, a nonprofit or an organization to support you in that first event. But after that, you got to figure it out on your own. And if you're a higher level quadriplegic or somebody that needs assistance, you have to get airfare to the event. You have to get a hotel room for a week. You have to double up all that if you're bringing a caregiver. And you normally have to pay for that person's food and all their expenses for the week too. So, you know, you multiply everything that you got to go through times two if you need support. And you can find out real quick that just isn't an option for most people. And you know, then you're left thinking, as anybody would there, well, adaptive sports obviously saves people's lives. There's at the wheelchair games, there's probably 600 individual accounts of that happening. And then you also quickly find out that money is a barrier of entry for who knows how many people that don't get to experience that because of that. So, you know, I very ignorantly said, I want to change that and let's start a nonprofit. And, you know, I went and I asked a buddy of mine that I went to high school with, who was an attorney, to file the necessary paperwork for us. And he told me right then, like, hey man, these are taking up to 2 years to get approved right now, just to warn you. So that's fine. Go ahead and file it. We'll file for an LLC, a business, right away and start getting the word out there. We'll sell T-shirts. We'll start raising some money through apparel sales. And by the time that thing gets approved, we might have some traction. And that's basically how the two different entities were born.
And what's the purpose of the Oscar Mike Foundation?
To keep injured veterans on the move. Oscar Mike means on the move. It's radio jargon that we use in Iraq all the time. If somebody said, I need you to get Oscar Mike, you didn't even hesitate. You just started moving. And, you know, that our mission is just that, keep injured veterans on the move.
And so the funds that get donated to the Oscar Mike Foundation or get plowed over from the Oscar Mike apparel sales allow the foundation to assist in the veterans getting out and being involved in adaptive sports, as I understand it.
That's correct. And we've got ourselves in a whole bunch of adaptive sports now. What started as a couple really was just in support of some of the bigger events that happen. But now we have a facility. It's just a large home, about 9,000 square feet with 14 beds in it. That we bring in injured veterans every week, and we teach them about 9 different adaptive sports while they're in for a 3 or 4 day clinic every week. And we do stuff all over the country. We still do the skiing events. We do the National Veteran Wheelchair Games. We have surfing clinics. We have skydiving clinics. We have, you know, you name it. If we can adapt it or figure out a way to get you through it, we're going to. And one of our biggest things now is obstacle course races. You take somebody with a serious injury and you ask them to if they're interested in going through an obstacle course race, they like a Spartan race, the first thing that would come through their head would be, there's no way I can do that. Well, we prove that wrong all the time, and we provide a team of people, usually a platoon size or larger, and we make sure that you get through that entire course safely and efficiently, and you're left at the end of it thinking that anything is possible. So, like I said, we've got our hands in a lot of different adaptive sports, and I feel like we're finally at a stage in the game where we get to legitimately affect and change lives every day.
And Noah, tell us about Oscar Mike Apparel.
Oscar Mike Apparel, it's an all-American made apparel company that supports our nonprofit. I feel like we're the only ones probably on the planet with an American made, a 100% American made brand. And especially one at that, that gives back to a cause. Normally if you do have an American made entity of some sort, the margins aren't really there to, you know, if you were starting a business on your own, you'd probably want to keep those proceeds for yourself or whatever, the case may be. But with us, it only exists to support the nonprofit. So, you know, in the beginning, when you're starting a nonprofit, there's all sorts of overhead associated with that, especially if you have to have staff members and all the travel and, you know, the things that our nonprofit wanted to offer. So, or in a facility, a home base, you know, but our apparel company removes all of that overhead for the nonprofit. It absorbs all of that. So, let's say you were going to donate a dollar to, you know, other organizations. Anywhere up to 99 cents of that dollar goes to the overhead to run the nonprofit. And at the end of the day, a lot of times it's really only about a penny that makes it to the actual veteran or the program. Where with us, that number is flip-flop the other way around, because, you know, we have essentially the greatest corporate partner in the world. We created it, so we get to dictate how it spends its money, and it's doing good.
It's a great relationship, and I want to encourage our Veteran Radio listeners to get out and look at Oscar Mike, look at the apparel, look at the gear that's available that you can purchase, and know that you're supporting the foundation. Noah Currier, where can folks find the Oscar Mike gear and foundation information?
Go to oscarmike.org. That's where you're going to find the most information in one spot.
And you've been doing this for a number of years now, right? This is not a brand new deal.
Right. No, we launched on Veterans Day, 11/11/11. So we've been doing it since then.
Well, it's great work that you're doing. It's the combination of having a apparel company that helps fund the foundation's a brilliant idea. You should take credit for that. You are also out and about talking to veterans groups on a regular basis, kind of telling them your story and getting the word out about Oscar Mike. You'll be in the Metro Detroit, Michigan area in November. With the Michigan PVA. Do you want to give a plug to that luncheon?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how they're selling tickets or opening that up to, you know, or if it is open to the public, but I would encourage you to check that out. And if you can get a ticket to that luncheon, I will definitely be there speaking, and I will share probably a little bit more about the entire story. And I would look forward to meeting anybody I can there.
Well, we want to encourage the local veterans to get out. You can find more about the Salute to Veterans Luncheon Gala to www.michiganpva.org, and that'll direct you to how to get some tickets to hear Noah and get a chance to hear more about the Oscar Mike story. Noah, thanks for spending some time with us today on Veterans Radio.
We hope you enjoyed these programs on Veterans Radio. Follow us on Facebook. And until next time, you are dismissed.